Ed is going to be speaking on steps 6 and 7, which are,
we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly asked him to remove all our shortcomings. So, Ed, we're excited to hear what you have to say.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. Last week, talked about steps 4 and 5, and I want to go back in the big book after we're in step 5. It says, we park out our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past, where, you know, we open up and share, admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. The next paragraph says, you know, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. For we are building an arch through which we shall walk, a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? It goes on to say, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us to be willing. When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. So, thanks everybody. I'll see you next week. you know, at the time, when I got to that point in the steps, boy, you know, my sponsor, he was like, you know, don't be fooled by the brevity in the book. You know, there's a scant 2 paragraphs, and it took me a long time to realize the power in these 2 steps. you know, in chapter 5, how it works, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And then there's a whole chapter, and then it goes on after that into action, and on and on. And, you know, I've said a few times back then when I first started getting into the steps with my sponsor, it was quite a few years in the program, actually. And my big book was, like I said, it was in mint condition. So, you know, something like that would have been intimidating to me. But I've learned over the years that a lot of us in AA are kind of suckers for acronyms, you know. Fear, you know, false evidence appearing real, or failure expected and received. Ego, easing God out. God, good orderly direction. But there's one I want to talk about today, and that's how. You know, how it works, how. To be honest, open, and willing. And so far, in my experience, steps 1 through 4, I had to really get honest, you know, for so long, and I don't want to spend a lot of time what I talked about a few weeks ago, but just admitting that I had a problem and accepting it, you know, was a big deal, and it took a lot of honesty to myself. It was pointed out to me by countless people, and I didn't like it, but until I accepted it and really was honest with myself. Step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. In my experience, that was the open. part of how it works. I had to open up. My sponsor calls it a default position. You know, it's where I go to automatically without thinking. It's like, you know, the old wagons down the old roads. You know, they tend to fall back into the ruts all by themselves, and I can find myself there. My default position is to close up. You know, just clam up, go into the cave. And I used to spend a lot of time down there, years before I got here, and then months and then weeks, and I still do it, you know. step six is the beginning of the end of that acronym, HOW. The willingness, you know. And for that, you know, for me, step five says, you know, we park on our pride and we go for it, and we look at every cranny of the past. there are, we read, at a lot of different meetings, we read different promises, you know, the nine-step promises on page 82. But on page 75, once we have taken, and they're talking about step five here, once we have taken this step withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone, at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. A few more promises in the big book that... at the time, I had to watch out for, because I didn't really know them top of mind. That came with time, but I experienced this myself, and I've seen other people, where you get to that certain point in the program where things start getting better, you know? And you get on that pink cloud. It's like being in that place where you feel like you're halfway to heaven, but you're really only barely a half a mile out of hell. And it was all new to me, getting sober, early sobriety, all that good stuff that was happening. I don't know if I mentioned it here before, but at the time I was sharing an apartment with my sister, and a few months had gone by, and she'd seen me in the worst of things, and I told her, I says, man, you know, things are going so good, you know, like I'm waiting for the boom to fall, you know. And these are her words, so if you want to blip them out on the recorder, that's up to you. But she said, you asshole, that's how it's supposed to be, you know, because I never lived my life like that. My life was a life of fear, you know. I was paranoid. It was just crazy, you know. I've seen a lot of people on a pink cloud. I've been there myself. And I still had that, a lot of fears inside me. I still had that need to control things, you know. I had to have the reins to a certain degree, even if it wasn't out in the open, you know. And as long as I did that, I wasn't willing to move forward. In my mind, I could convince myself that I was. But in reality, practically, I really wasn't. And I had a crash off of that pink cloud, you know. So grateful that I didn't have to pick up. Mine manifested itself in a little different way. I got really resentful at some of the people in the program, and I talked a little bit about that before. I've seen other people crash off that pink cloud and go out and get drunk. Again, just grateful. So, I had to move on. I had to become willing, or I was going to be stuck. And I was stuck in that dry drunk for quite a while, you know. So, giving up control, that was the hardest thing for me to do with these steps here, step six especially. I say this to people I work with. I say this to newcomers. I don't tell people what they should do. You know, I mentioned here before, right from the very beginning, I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope, not my opinions, my advice, and my fears. I might suggest you want to do something. I'll try and, you know, if I've been through something, I'll try and let you know how that worked out for me. But how many times I've asked people that I work with or new people when they're just complaining or whatever, and things, I can see them, you know, I can see them holding on to the reins. And I say, how's that working out for you? You know? And you can see the look on their face. They don't like that, you know? I make it a point not to tell them that you're screwing up, because so many times I was on the receiving end of that and I would just shut down and run. So, how's it working out for you? So, I had to turn that around. That old finger pointing this way and three pointing back. It's like, how's that working out for me? You know? And again, thank God for the sponsor that I had to help me work through these things. So, I had to work on building trust. And you know, from my previous talks here over the last few weeks, that was a big issue for me. It started with trust in a higher power, as I understand him, and I'm going to talk more about that in a couple weeks. I had to build trust in myself, you know. I had to get a grasp, get a handle on what my own limitations were. I had to make some mature boundaries and things. I had to look at the past results of all, you know, the consequences of my own actions, like I talked about last week, you know. Then I had to start to build trust in others, you know. In my sponsor, I had already begun that, you know. I'd already done the fifth step with him. I've told him things that I would, you know, had a hard time admitting to myself for years, you know. So I had to build trust in my higher power, in myself, and then in other people. And then beyond my sponsor, I had to start seeing other people more as equals in this program. Aside from all the surface stuff, you know. Not the car you drive, not the house you live in, not, you know, any of that stuff. The schools you went to or that. I had to quit comparing and I had to start relating to people. And that was humbling, you know. it was a beginning of, it started out basically just with some tolerance, you know. And baby steps. It was like tolerance in the purest form of the word. It was like just putting up with people or just dealing with people and still being able to keep my mouth shut, you know. That kind of morphed into understanding, you know, because the more I was willing to open up and ask for help and look outside of myself, I was able to see how you and I were so much more alike than we are different. And that comes through fellowship, you know. We talk about the triangle of fellowship, unity, and service. And that's what fellowship did to me, you know. It got me when I was willing to move forward, when I knew that I had to. It got me to open up and start realizing that, you know, we're more alike than we are different. I've got to give you the benefit of the doubt. I don't know what you've been through just by looking at you. And I got to quit complaining, you know. That tolerance morphed into understanding. That understanding starts to morph into compassion, you know. By looking at someone, and when I listen to their story, or I see what they're going through, it's like, man, you know, I've been there. And I can actually feel what you're feeling now. Instead of thinking, you should do this, or if only you do this, think your life would be so much better. So that takes a lot of effort, and I'm the type of person historically that, you know, would love to pull the tricks out of my bag and figure it out how to do it by myself. But that building trust in other people and my higher power and in myself takes a lot of energy, you know. mental, psychic, spiritual energy. And so I had to return all the time back to my higher power, asking for that help. And I would start to doubt myself there at times. And again, it was that seeking to first of all acknowledge what it is, you know. And then I'd have my bad days and bad moments, and I'd look at people and they'd get me upset again, you know, and it would be like right back where I was. So I'm not saying that I got caught in a loop, and because to me that connotes that I'm not really making any progress. But I found myself in a circle, in a sense, that just when I was able to gain some trust in my higher power and in myself and some other people, that doesn't mean, boom, I got him, all done, figured it out, now he can move on, you know? So it's kind of circular that way. I've got to go back to my higher power. You know, the times I doubt myself, the times that people, you know, rub me the wrong way, and I gotta keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. It's a painful process, you know, but I gain depth. So it's really not a circle, you know. It's maybe an upward spiral. I don't know. Maybe that's not the best metaphor. Over the years, a lot of you probably heard it, you know, it could be akin to the saying, you know, it's like peeling an onion, you know. a lot of crying involved, but if you want to make progress. And I understood that, you know, back when I first heard it. But I heard a story, and it came a long time ago, and it came to mind just a couple days ago at my home group. With the topic we had back then, and you know, I mentioned that it can be a painful process to go through. There's a movie, Denzel Washington is in it, The Equalizer. I don't know if you ever saw it. And the scene on the train when he's going to Turkey, and he says, "There's two kinds of pain in this world: the pain that hurts, and pain that alters." And for years, I suffered the hurt, you know. It was the poor me's. It was the world is screwed up. It was pointing fingers. But when I got to the point where I started to experience the pain that alters, you know, when you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, and you start peeling those layers back to get that insight, you know, into yourself. Not easy to do, but boy, is that rewarding. So I'm going to tell you this little story, and again, it came to mind at my home group just a couple days ago. it's an old Swedish folk tale. It's about a young princess named Aris, A-R-I-S, I think is her name. But she found out that because of some misdeeds of her parents, there was a curse on her, and she was cursed to marry a dragon, a fearful dragon. And once she realized this, she was full of fear, and she did everything she could to get out of it. And she knew of a wise woman that lived in the woods that had raised 12 kids and 30 grandkids, and she knew the ways of men and dragons, and she went to see her, and she says, "How can I get out of this?" And she says, "You can't get out of this. There's like no easier, softer way. You have to go through it, but let me tell you what might help you." And she says, "On your wedding day, you need to wear 12 beautiful wedding gowns, one over the top of the other." And then she told her what she needed to do after that. Well, they had the wedding, the feast, everything else. They were ready. The dragon comes by and he swoops up this girl and takes him up to the bedchamber. And she says, "Now, wait a minute." She said, "Before I give myself to you, I have to take off my beautiful wedding gowns." And so she took off the first gown. And he made an advance. And he says, "Now wait, but you have to do the same thing." So he took off a layer of scales. It was uncomfortable. He'd done it before because I guess dragons molt. But so he says, "Yeah, sure, okay, I'll do this." So she took off another layer. And then she said to him, "Now you have to take off another layer." And she was down to about the fifth or the sixth wedding gown. And the dragon is just screaming in agony that he's ripping off all these inner layers of scales. Just weeping at the pain. And she got down to her last gown, took it off. He took off his last layer of scales, and he turned into this compassionate, handsome young prince, you know. And you'd think that this being a folklore, that the next line is they lived happily ever after, but that was just the beginning. That's basically that story in a nutshell. So it's kind of a little bit more expansive than just peeling the onion. Because what that means to me, why I relate to that story is there's a letting go there. There's a letting go of things that I'm not even aware of. I mean, here's this prince that didn't know he was a prince, just thought he was this fearsome dragon. it's like an armor that I put up over myself, over my character, over my heart. It was an armor that shut out, like the big book says, it shut out that sunlight of the spirit, you know. And that was a side effect of that control that I had to have. So, I'm going to talk about another little circle here, you know. Shedding these scales. It's the scales that I had to shed. And this has become part of my meditative practice. you know, they say it's a threefold disease, mind, body, and spirit. And in very real terms, I had to let go by way of through my mind, my body, and my spirit, and my heart. And the way that I do this is, as far as physically, my body, you know, there are times, again, like that prince that didn't realize he was a dragon. There are times that I am so tense and so uptight, and I don't even realize it until I've been taught, and I can catch myself on occasion. Sometimes I need to be reminded that just sit down, feel the tension in your neck, Ed. You know, feel the tension in your shoulders. How hard are you holding on to the TV remote control or the steering wheel, you know? It's a tension, it's a habitual contraction, a physical contraction that I'm not even aware of. So I have to pay attention to that. I'd become aware. And it'll talk more in the coming weeks about that spiritual experience and that spiritual awakening. So there's that tension and there's that contraction, and the habitual ways I do that, and it can manifest itself in restlessness and resistance and irritability, you know, very in a very physical sense. So I had to become aware. Now, as far as, you know, my spirit goes, again, I'm talking about willingness here. I'm talking about the sixth step, you know. There were more unconscious contractions there. You know, I had to face these energies of grasping, you know, that control. I couldn't let go. I had to have something else in order to be better, in order to, you know, to be fixed. That anger, the pride, the fear, you know, the ego. when I grasp onto things, my spirit slam shut, you know, because then that becomes a priority. That becomes my focus. so I had to name what those were, you know. I had to face that. I had to pull off another layer of those scales and actually look at it and give it a name, you know. By virtue of doing that fifth step, I was able to, you know, get a little more accustomed to doing those types of things. Not only did I have to name what those things were, but I had to face and acknowledge the stories that they told my mind, you know, because I'm BSing myself, you know. I'm really good at rationalizing things. If something's uncomfortable, I can, you know, I got to figure out a way to make it go away. And that pushes the world away, you know. It pushes the bad stuff away, but it pushes the good stuff away too. And I'm stuck right where I was before, you know. So I had to acknowledge, and I had to search for the anger and the fear and the judgment and the blame and everything that lived inside of myself. Now, as far as my mind went in that circle, the practice for me is I had to become aware that I am lost in thought. You know, I am constantly talking to myself. The stream of thoughts is like never ending. You know, that's when my sponsor, and I said this before, last week or the week before, you know, says, Ed, your mind is behind enemy lines. Your mind is out to kill you, you know, because it was just automatic. You know, I couldn't stop it. I didn't know how to stop it. I didn't know that I needed to stop it. ambitions, doubts, fears, opinions, my own self-image, you know. all these were the themes of that inner dialogue. That were holding me back. So, I had to... And again, that pushes the world away, but it takes me out of the moment, you know, because I'm thinking about something completely different. And that is a hard thing to do, is to stay into the moment. Stay in the moment, rather. So, I had to unmask these stories that I was telling myself. So, by relaxing my body... letting go of all the old stories, you know, in my mind, let them slip away, softening my heart, opening my spirit, you know, I started to begin to see things as they are. And only then, you know, could I ask my higher power for help in taking them away. Because just to read those two paragraphs, those few sentences, I could say, yeah, I'm willing to have you take all this crap away. Don't know what it is. So please take it away. Don't know what they are. And next thing you know, I'm in a jam again, because I haven't done that. I haven't done that work. I haven't put forth that. I haven't started to strip off those scales or peel that onion or however you want to call it. So once I started to do that, I started to see things as they really are. And a lot of it was uncomfortable, but at the same time, it was extremely freeing and liberating. I had to let go of how it was, how it should be, and how I should be. Because, you see, I had this whole narrative in my mind about who I am. And a lot of it, like I read that paragraph. Did we skip on the is there too much sand in the cement? Did we skip on the foundation? And that's what my foundation, you know, part of it was built on. You know, that crazy idea I had of how I should be. You know, I had no idea how I should be. You know, I'd read a book and I'd find something profound, and you know. There my mind goes again, and that there goes my thoughts, and then whoop, then I'm off again. So when I'm able to let those narratives go, I'm able to get back more into the present moment. And I've heard it said it's the eternal moment. it was Ram Dass, I think, if you know who he is. He said, be here now, you know. Simple instruction, you know, tough to do. The eternal present. All I have is right now, right here. I'm going to talk more about meditation when I get to the prayer meditation when I get to the 11th step. But for right now, I will share with you one of the things that really helps me. and that's acknowledging that the present is all I have, right here, right now, you know. My cat does not exist right now. You know, the pear trees in my yard, they don't exist right now. My yard does not exist right now in a very real sense, you know. Yeah, sure they exist, but in a very real sense they don't. All that I have is right here, right now. And that's fleeting, you know. I can tap into that here and there. I have an awakening here and there, and I have a little experience of it here and there. And then the next thing you know, my heart slams shut. My mind takes off running. I get all tensed up. And I don't even realize it, you know, until Mary pokes me, you know, and says, like when I'm, oh man, there's 8 kids in our family, you know, and man, when we ate dinner, you ate fast, you know, if you wanted to get your share. And it's a habit, I do this thing. She says, come up for air, you know. I got to come up for air every now and then. In very real ways, you know. I got to catch myself, and I'm getting better at it. I don't do it all the time. I did it here on the way. People driving, you know, it's like, they say that, you know, the 6 and 7, they talk about practicing these principles. Well, what are the principles? They're the opposite of your defects. Do the opposite of what you did. You know, very simple. Okay, how am I supposed to do the opposite of what I don't know exists? So, you know, like I said, those moments are fleeting, and they're only preparation for a longer, deeper journey. And again, I can fall back into that loop. I can get discouraged. I can start thinking about how the world should be and how things should be and how I should be. But you see, because I've had that experience, because I've had a little bit of an awakening, because I've opened up and became willing and asked for some help, you know, I know that's there. And I know that I can get it again. Sometimes I don't remember what I say from minute to minute, let alone week to week. Excuse me if I said this before, but it's like, boy, you know, you take a hike and you come out on top of a tall hill or plateau, and you look out and the expanse is just a beautiful, beautiful view. And next thing you know, you keep walking, and next thing you know, you're in high bramble, and it starts getting muddy, and you're getting cut up, and the mosquitoes are biting, and back in that loop. But I remember that view from that hilltop, and I know that there's another hilltop with a more spectacular view, and I just have to keep, putting one foot in front of the other. So, Bill Wilson kind of equated that to the beginning of emotional sobriety. He wrote a letter in the Grapevine about that, and there's some awesome books, Emotional Sobriety 1 and Emotional Sobriety 2. Our home group just finished doing those discussion meetings on. We went through both of those books. So I'm learning to develop new habits. You know, it's step 7. I'm going to ask them to remove our shortcomings. This isn't some Penn and Teller show, you know, where they're going to make something disappear. It's not an illusion, you know. And I could BS myself into believing that. So I had to develop new habits, and I had to develop a new default position. So what helps me? Like I said, sometimes Mary yelling at me, come up for air. But on my own, more and more, I'm able to just sit. And one of the mantras that I say, and I do many different types of meditation, and again, more on that in a couple weeks, but very simply, only here, only now. That's all there is. Only here, and only now. And that's all I have. So,
thank you, Ed. So now we would like to ask if anybody has any questions for our speaker. If you're in the room, you can go ahead and raise your hand, and if you're on Zoom, just go ahead and speak up when you have the opportunity. So who would like to get us started?
Jim, alcoholic. Thanks, Ed.
Hey, Jim.
So, after you finished step 5 with your sponsor and you were off to spend an hour or so of quiet time alone, did you have any any questions about what you had just done or any difficulty with being ready to have those character defects removed? Now, I hear people talk about, you know, some of my character defects I didn't really want to let go of because they were kind of fun or whatever.
Yeah. He's asking if that, after I did step five in that contemplation, you know, did I have, second thoughts or...
I guess just if you were had a clear understanding,
of what you had
just gone through.
Of what I'd gone through, what it meant, what I needed to do, and if I was ready to move forward. I really was, you know. I knew as much at that point as I possibly could for the experience that I just had. I couldn't know the whole ball of wax because none of us can, and more shall be revealed. So, yeah, I did. I was comfortable with what I just did with the fourth and fifth step with my sponsor. There were things that I can honestly say that there's... I never really said to myself, I really don't want to let that one go, you know? Because, like I said, I was a low-bottom drunk, and I never wanted to go back there again. And there were things that, again, more should be revealed. There were character defects that didn't surface until years later, you know? Like I talked about my dad a little bit last week. His dad was an alcoholic. And only years later, talking to a cousin of mine who was 20, 25 years older than I was, and he knew a little bit more of the family history, you know, and then things started to, you know, a few more pieces fell into place, and I saw my part in that. And it wasn't like my pride says, well, you know, they did that too, or whatever. And I'm just going to... So at that point, no, you know.
One other thing I just thought of. Could something that I consider a character defect in myself, could you possibly not consider that a character defect in yourself?
He's saying if he recognizes a defect in himself, can I recognize that as not a defect in myself? I don't know. I guess we'd have to talk more about specifics. maybe ignorance falls into that. You know, when I become aware, and like I said, when I start to develop that tolerance, and then that understanding, and then that compassion, and that empathy, it's tough for me not to look at somebody that's going through some crap and not give a damn. You know, to say, it sucks to be you, and I hear that a lot. You know, I hear that a lot from the guys I work with. You know, and they mean it. You know, and it's like, yeah, it does, but I have to rub your face in it. So. Yeah, I don't know, you know.
Fair enough.
Who else would like to ask a question?
Eric, alcoholic.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, Ron. Do you, like, prioritize character defects when you're trying to work on them? I know you said it's painfully slow sometimes. Like, if you recognize that you have, let's say, half a dozen to a baker's dozen of things that you like immediately want to try to work on, do you like prioritize those with your sponsor? I mean, I'm an overthinker too, so I could try to dissect, you know, self-centeredness, people pleasing, ego, all that stuff. So
mm-hmm.
How do you go about that?
He's asking if I prioritize my defects, basically, right?
Yeah.
it's kind of like more when they pop up. Like I said, at that time, you know, I had already done that searching and fearless moral inventory, so a lot of stuff came to the surface. In the time after that, a few more things became apparent, and then as the years go by, even to this day, things become apparent. So do I prioritize them as, like, this defect is worse than that defect? I don't know that I do. Never really thought about it, but I think if something comes up and it pops up in front of me, it's like... It's like I'm coming down 12th Street, and you know, I'm hoping to get the lights, but this light changes red. Well, I'm going to stop for it, you know. I don't care if Peach and Sassafras are turning red, you know. I'm stopping for State Street, because that's where it is right now. and then we'll deal with those as I get down there. So it seems to me that I would hopefully try and take care of them as they come up. You know, when a whole bunch of them come up, boy. You know, I've been in some jams, you know, and that's where that humility comes in. That's where asking for help comes in, from a higher power, from other people, a sponsor, other people that have gone through stuff. So, and then sometimes it's just, I got to look back, you know, what is AA? Fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope, so that we can get sober and help others to recover, you know. And sometimes, here's another acronym for you, I got to keep it simple, stupid, you know. So instead of trying to figure out the whole ball of wax, you know, like, so maybe in a sense I do prioritize them, and maybe it's more unconsciously or subconsciously, but it's not that I list them on paper and say, oh, being fearful is a worse defect than being angry, and that's worse than blaming people, and if I'll take care of this one first, because I find, you know, life is complex and nuanced, and things get intertwined, and it's like a Gordian knot, you know, you just, one thing leads to another, and it's always there, but there's that hilltop again. So no, I don't know that I do, and if I do, it subconsciously. Thank so.
How about anybody on Zoom? Anybody on Zoom have a question?
Quiet bunch.
Who else has a question for Ed?
I tried to stretch it out.
And I'm going to stretch it out more.
Kevin.
We make a great team, Ed. Thank you very much. Thanks for your share. That was really interesting. I wrote down a few things that I thought were... I liked the way you described the difference between pain, hurt, and, you know, the pain or hurt
pain
that
alters. Yeah.
Could you explain that a little bit more?
Oh, he's asking if I could explain a little more the difference between the pain that hurts and the pain that alters. like I said, for years I suffered that pain that hurt, you know. Through my drinking, through my excessive behavior, through my... boy, I abused everything you put in front of me, you know, from money, people, everything. And it wasn't working out. Like I said, how's it working out for you? It wasn't working out too good, you know. And I was hurting myself. I know I was hurting myself physically. I mean, you know, when you go to the bathroom and you have diarrhea and it's nothing but pure red blood, something's wrong, you know. That's not social drinking. I know I was hurting myself mentally because my thinking was really screwed up, you know. I said this before, you know, my mantra wasn't you don't get even, you get ahead, or you don't get mad, you get even. Mine is you don't get even, you get ahead. My thinking was screwed up. And like I said, there's just that hole inside, you know, that I didn't even know was there, that I was trying to fill. And standing on the edge of that abyss, you know, boy, I'll never forget that. I can't put it into words. If you've been there, you know. That's the pain that hurts. But I still kept trying, you know. I was going to figure this out. And, man, it's like the coyote, you know. It ain't really working out for you, you know. The roadrunner's doing a number on you. But I still kept going at it, still kept going at it, still kept going at it. And I didn't even realize it. That's the thing. Now, the pain that alters, you know, when I had those glimpses, even in the worst of my alcoholism, you know, when I realized, like I mentioned here, I think it was in my first talk, there were three times in my life that I wept. And one of those when I was drinking and I did something to someone. And you know, there are things to this day I cringe, you know. and I knew somewhere deep down inside of me, I didn't want to be like that. I didn't know how not to be that way. But that, the pain that hurt turned into the pain that altered it. That was the pain that drove me to seek some kind of change. You know, I had to change or I was going to die. And I knew that. I knew that last night when I drove around and started saying goodbye to people. You know, like I mentioned, I it was not on my mind, and I wasn't contemplating suicide. I just knew that I wasn't going to be alive the next day. That's the pain that alters, you know. Especially, like I said, deep down inside, every single one of us, you know, if you really believe, as I do, that God doesn't make junk, you know, and that we're all part of the divine, there's something in there. You know, you can call it a conscience, you know, you can call it that good orderly direction, you can call it whatever you want to, but something in there is eating at me, you know. And that was a pain that I couldn't drown by drinking. That was a pain I couldn't run away from. That was a pain that I had to face. So,
anybody else?
I'm going to keep talking until somebody else has a question. Ed, thank you. The other thing I'd like you to clarify is you talked about that acronym of HOW, you know, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. You said that steps 1 through 4 were about honesty, and that step 5 was about openness, and you said 6 was about willingness. Does, you know, where do like 7, 8, and 9 come in? And
they're all intermeshed. He's asking where, you know, that acronym HOW. I said 1 through 4, the H, and the 5 is O, and 6, 7 is a willingness, but it just keeps on going. You know, it's part of that circle. You get caught in that loop, that playback loop, you know, and it's this time it's a positive feedback loop instead of a negative feedback loop. You know, before I'd do something crappy, didn't like myself, get smashed, black out, found out I did something even worse, said I wasn't ever going to do it again, felt like crap, drank again, and that's a negative feedback loop. But it's like, when I answered your question about prioritizing, when something pops up, it's like, hey, you know, this is what it is. I got to name it. I got to own it. You know, I got to address it. I got to be willing to do this. I got to be honest about it. You know, and I got to. So that's a positive feedback loop. So, I didn't mean to give you the impression that every step is, you know, related to one of those. It just kind of got me off the dime here to get going. But it's true. It did relate in that way to me. So,
all right. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks, everybody.
Next week.